That's punctuality.
And I am the MC of the event.
I've heard. How are you? Fire.
Oh, my God. Very nicely done.
You and Val have
families and attractors.
Freaking me out. Must be getting close to election time.
I was here first.
Everybody.
What are you leaving? Doing a keyboard to old shaky there?
Good to see
you. Mr. Okay, it's about that time, troops. Are we ready to roll? Shelly?
Yep.
We'll call to order the Interim Committee on Business and Labor. Nice to see all of you, committee members. Nice to see all of you. Welcome back.
Nice to be seeing.
Thank you. Thank you. I hope you've had a good summer and all of those good things. We've got a fairly busy agenda today, and we'll move through it quickly. Our first item, though, is under organization, is we need to adopt committee rules. You should have an updated version from yesterday afternoon at your chair. Take a moment. I don't know if you've had a chance to read through them or not, but anyhow, we need to adopt those. Mr. Co-Chair, you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the rules.
Okay. Co-Chair Schaffler moves that we adopt the rules. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, I guess introduction of committee members is next. Actually, our committee stays the same. That isn't true of all committees. Right. But Representative Johnson, you want to go ahead and let's start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mark Johnson, House District 52, representing all of Mount Hood, although I represent less of it now because a lot of it went up in smoke the last month. But
You were up there some too.
I was, have been there frequently. Yeah, so, and the beautiful Columbia River Gorge, and now have 3,000 brand new voters in Multnomah County we're getting acquainted with, and just living the dream.
Someday you'll have to come. Sherry and I collect old Oregon paintings. We have a 1919 of Crown Point built in 1917. But you recall just prior to that, there was a forest fire. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like the Columbia Gorge was clear cut in 1917. And
not that there'd be anything wrong with it.
And Mr. Chair, you'll be pleased to know that it grew back.
Damn right it did, yeah.
Better than ever.
Oh, renewable.
Okay. Val?
Representative Val Hoyle, representing House District 14, West Eugene, Junction City, Cheshire, and Albador.
Okay.
Representative Esquivel, Sal Esquivel from Medford.
Mike Schaffler, House District 48, Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland.
Bill Kennemer, currently Gladstone, Oregon City, and surrounding areas, be losing part of Oregon City. So.
Margaret Doherty, House District 35, King City, Tigard, and Southwest Portland.
Greg Matthews, House District 50, which was primarily Gresham, but now has become a little bit of a Southeast Portland area. Lost some of my Gresham residents, and thanks for that. All of you who helped us with the redistricting. Thank you. Great to be here.
Do I hear love and affection in your voice?
No way, Greg. I was on redistricting when we adjourned.
My fault.
Jason Conger, House District 54, City of Bend.
Are you not going to whine on the same topic?
He stole my line.
Okay.
I was saving for that.
Very good. And?
Oh, of course. Teresa Van Winkle, committee administrator, and also Shelley Rasko, who is continuing on as our committee assistant.
Very good. For the good of the order, anything else anyone wants to say before we move into our invited testimony today? Okay. Our first item, then, is Home Sweet Home Program. And we have three folks. Please come forward. Please give us your name and affiliation, and let's proceed.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Pleasure to be here before you. on our little short hiatus away from each other in our two-week-long summer that we had here.
Did you miss us?
I did.
Thank you.
Which is exactly why I asked to have the opportunity to present this great program that we've entered into with our home foundation and the Bankers Association, and something that I think would benefit your constituents. But I wanted to take a step back and kind of give you guys a little bit of a refresher, in that in the 2009 session, we had House Bill 2436, which was actually introduced by the co-chair on behalf of the Housing Alliance, the Oregon Association of Realtors, the Oregon Bankers Association, and the Oregon Home Builders Association. And in that bill, you all remember, there was an increase to the document recording fee, but that increase was all dedicated to affordable housing programs, which is why you had that broad cross-section of groups all supporting it. I think it's nice that you all can see that something you enacted has now led to some of the programs that we have here. A portion of that bill provided that there would be what are called home ownership assistance programs, down payment assistance programs, and that's really come to fruition now. So with that, co-chairs, I'm actually going to turn it over to the experts who administer the program and know a lot more about it than I do, and I have my colleague here who runs our home foundation, and she can kind of walk you through the program a little bit.
Good morning. My name is Jenny Pakula, and I'm Vice President of Legal Affairs and Business Development at the Oregon Association of Realtors. In 2004, the realtors obviously saw the need for helping with affordable housing, and we established the Home Foundation. The Home Foundation is a 501c3 organization dedicated to providing grant assistance to other 501c3s committed to affordable housing. I know many of your districts have benefited from grants from the Home Foundation, such as Habitats, Home for Our Troops, which is East Metro, Gresham. A couple military guys got houses built for them in Gresham with funds from our Home Foundation. And we've provided almost $400,000 in grants to organizations such as those over the years. And in 2010, the National Association of Realtors was awarding grants for workforce housing. One of the criteria to receive the grants was to enter into a partnership with other industry affiliates. And Linda Navarro and myself have worked together on numerous things, and I thought no better partner than the bankers, particularly given the situation over the last few years. We were awarded a grant to start the Home Sweet Home program, initial grant of $80,000 last year. The criteria was for first-time home buyers, meaning you couldn't have owned a home for the past 3 years. They had to be 80% or below median income for their communities, and a variety of other criteria. They had to work with a member of the Oregon Bankers Association and a member of the Oregon Association of Realtors. And last year we gave the money, obviously went very quick. It was $2,000 grants, not a loan, grants, along with $500 matching from the banker through appraisal, closing costs, whatever. So we, this May of 2011, the Bankers Association got another grant of $100,000 to continue funding this program through OHCS. So we have another 50 grants or so to give out of $2,000. And so to date, we've helped probably at least 60 first-time home buyers in many of your districts get into homes over the last year. And we're very excited to continue with this program. So obviously, we need to continue finding ways to sustain funding, which is another criteria of receiving the initial grant funds. So far we're doing good, and we hope to continue the program, and it's been very successful.
A question for you. $2,000 grants, pretty good. It's nice it's a grant. The other piece of that is, what is the typical down payment for people that are borrowing through or working through this program? Do you have an idea? Because I just wondered what percentage that is. That's probably a substantial amount of it.
Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, it's more than it used to be for the down payments. Typically.
Thank you. Is that a banking statement and factual,
I presume? FHA.
Mr. Chair, this guy better identify himself.
Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association.
There we go. Got him on the record now.
For FHA, it's typically 3%.
Yeah.
So that, and I would imagine many of these loans are FHA insured. So 3%, I think, would probably be the average.
Yeah, it's really interesting right at the moment. Interest rates are low enough. It's really made quite a difference, or it can make quite a difference in the housing.
One of the other criteria for the program is that no more than 50% of the available funds can go to the metro area. So many of Josephine County has benefited. Deschutes County has had a huge number of these grants. So it's nice to see the money going to other areas of the state other than just Portland Metro, which I realize many people need the money there. It's harder for first-time homebuyers to get in up there with just $2,000. So.
Yeah.
That's a nice criteria.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, it's great to see your smiling faces again. It seems like we were just here. I don't know where summer went, but I am going to make a copy of this tape because Mr. Jillian's called me an expert, and in all the years I've worked with Sean, I've never been called an expert by Sean. So I look forward to sharing that with you as we go forward into the next session. The Oregon Bankers Association, and I'm not Linda Navarro either. She sends her regrets and apologies. She is out of state at a meeting of area bankers. But the OBA has been involved in home ownership programs. I've been around since 1990, since well before that. I believe it was the 91 session, we worked with then Representative Bob Repine and Senator Jim Hill at the time to set up and Senator Kennedy was around at that point too, to set up the Oregon Housing Trust Fund. Unfortunately, that trust fund was never adequately funded and in fact has been used for other purposes over the last 20 years. But it was something that we felt was very important to establish. At about the same time, we began to organize and hold different home buying seminars in various communities around the state, Portland, Medford, Eugene, Bend, even once in a while in what I consider rural Oregon, Pendleton, and Klamath Falls. Those were, we've always been a big believer in education, financial literacy, and those were programs to help folks understand what the home buying process was all about, help them establish what they needed to do, develop their credit, develop down payments, and that was a very successful program. For the past 15 years, the OBA has worked with various partners to establish home buyer assistance programs and the grants that you just heard about in the $1,500 to $2,000 range. And in fact, we have records that we have helped over 600 families get into homes in that time frame. One thing you should know is the grants that we've either received, she mentioned the $100,000, and we've also in the past worked with the housing agency as well, the state housing agency as well. The OBA has never taken a dime for any administrative costs. We've always absorbed those costs internally and will continue to do so. We feel it's important that the borrowers benefit from this program and get the entire amount of the grant and not have any overhead as part of that. So we will continue to do that. As I mentioned, it was initially funded by the State of Oregon's Home Ownership Assistance Program, and it was designed in partnership with the Oregon Housing and Community Services a few years ago. Again, we've seen cutbacks all throughout state government. Those funds were cut. We were very, very happy and pleased to partner with the realtors to set up the current program. We think it works well. We think it's a good partnership. I have handed out to you kind of the one-pager about the program. We will continue to look for more money and to continue this program as long as we can in the future, because certainly we need, as the economy starts to recover, we need to get people back into homes and folks that are just coming up and, you know, coming out of college and young families, make sure they have the ability to buy a home going forward. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, you said 600. Do you have it broken down by year and where they are? Not the actual addresses, but you said district, or if you could put dots on a map or something, I'd just like to see that.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, we can certainly provide you with that.
And then, Mr.
Yep, please.
How many people, if you have this data, I don't have to answer it off the top of your head, apply, would qualify, but you run out of money. I mean, we're not spending a lot of money here. It's a lot of money for, but it isn't really. I'd be interested to see how much a demand, who qualifies, and who could make a payment if we could get them into a house.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to provide that. I can tell you that we run out of money every year.
Yeah.
We encourage folks that are interested in this program to apply early and get in early. I can just tell you, I can share with the committee, as far as this year is concerned, Deschutes County has received 30% of the funds so far, Josephine Excellent. County's 7.7, Lane County 7.7, Marion County 30%, Multnomah County 15.4, and Yamhill 7.7. So that's up to date for this year, and we still have you know, a little less than a quarter, to, or a little more than a quarter to go, I guess.
And that guy from Bend really knows how to bring home the bacon.
Better watch out; that could end up a campaign statement.
And Co-Chair Schaffler-Murray, I'll also provide you with what 80% of median is, because we also have that as well, so you can get an idea of what folks make in order to qualify for this program.
Representative Esquivel.
Now, what's the criteria on definition of a first-time home buyer? Is there a specific, it used to be a three-year
That's
period.
It.
Is that what it still remains the same?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
And clearly, Mr. Co-Vice Chair, members of the committee, you have to live in the house. This isn't something you can use as an investment. You have to yeah. not only be first-time home buyer, but live in it.
Whoops,
Yeah, it's great to see it implemented so quickly, and actually, given the current situation with foreclosures and availability of housing and interest rates, the timing is perfect as well. So, any further comments? Yes, Representative Conger, please.
Well, one comment, of course. Glad to hear you have your priorities straight about where you're applying the most effort for this program. Unfortunately, I think there's probably a relationship to need as well, mm-hmm. And that may account for some of the
flow.
I'd like to take credit, but I don't think I can.
And availability. There are some real issues.
Absolutely.
Foreclosures in your area.
My only question is, and it sounds like, you know, in Bend, probably the realtors are well aware, but how's the outreach accomplished? Is it through the realtor, so a person engages a realtor, or primarily through the lender, or how does that work?
Primarily, well, we do all of our marketing along with the bankers to our members. One of the important criteria, which I think has been one little hurdle, is that they do have to work with a member of the Bankers Association. Many mortgage people do not fall within that category, but obviously there's a lot of opportunity through their members. But, yeah, generally it starts with the realtor going to their banker. And we've tried to educate our members that they need to work with a member of the Bankers Association to qualify.
Co-chairs, Representative Conger, I think as the program gets going more fully, you see more press about it out there, and we did send some press releases out, and I actually noticed Representative Thatcher had in her newsletter this program for her constituents to be able to see that it was available there as well, and so I think that was part of the reason we brought it to you, so that you could pass the word along as well to all of your constituents that this program was out there, and it's a program that's facilitated by the actions that you all took.
Thank you for doing that, and I plan to at least put it in a newsletter and maybe bring it up at a town hall meeting or something, or work with the realtors or bankers locally to make sure that people know about it. So, thanks.
Representative Doherty.
Could you talk a little bit about the home buyer education program that you have? Because I think that was one of the problems. People were getting a little bit over their heads when it came to buying homes. I noticed you have an education component.
Representative Doherty, those are offered through OHCS state mm-hmm. programs that the bankers have identified as one of the criteria. And I know it's not through the bankers, but I believe it's through the state agency that offers the home buyer education courses. Mm-hmm. I don't exactly know how long the courses are or exactly what the curriculum of the course is.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Doherty, members of the committee, you know, as I mentioned, in the early 90s, we set these up around the state, and bankers at that point were giving up their evenings to conduct the classes, and they were generally 4 to 6 hours worth of classes. Over time, local municipalities, the state government have taken over that program and now offer the classes themselves. And they do have to be approved by the Bankers Association to make sure they cover the relevant topics. But it's really now up to the state. The state provides most of the training for that, and as well as some local jurisdictions.
Okay. Like the implications of home buying.
Right, right. And the importance of good credit, the importance of paying on time, the down payment, maintaining the home,
right.
all the typical things that you would think would be important.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Martinez.
Okay, any further questions or comments? We thank you for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Let's now move on to our second topic, injured workers' medical access to care. And let's begin with Dr. Vern Sabo. Hopefully, I understand you have a PowerPoint presentation, and Vern, you do need to introduce yourself for the record as well, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. And we've had discussions in MLAC, we've had discussions for quite some time relative to injured worker access to quality medical care. And so what we would tell you in the chiropractic profession, I think the naturopathic physicians would tell you the same, we believe that we're the part of the answer to solving the access problem. Currently, there's a number of, many of the medical physicians, the classic gatekeepers, the internists and family physicians, are refusing to treat injured workers. I treat or have treated many of the local internists and family docs. One of the ER heads became a patient of mine the other day, and they will tell you that there's a perception, there's just a whole lot of legal entanglements dealing with injured workers. But there's also another reason why they tend to not deal with back, for instance, and I'll get into that. We think part of the problem is the arbitrary restriction on chiropractic physicians who basically specialize in musculoskeletal conditions. It's not the only thing we treat. The other problem we would respectfully suggest that be considered is the extremely closed managed care panels across the state, extremely close to chiropractic physicians. For example, in Bend, Oregon, I have a colleague, Dr. John Scarborough, who's the only Spanish-speaking chiropractic physician in the entire Central Oregon area. And there's all, he cannot get on panel. None of my colleagues seem to be able to. It's restricted to three chiropractic physicians for all of Central Oregon, that geographic service area. The current requirement is only three provider types per geographic area. So that type of bottlenecking, we would say, makes little sense. Believe that the arbitrary restrictions on our profession, the chiropractic physician, which specializes, as I say, in musculoskeletal conditions, not the least of which are low back pain, low back injuries, which are the single most expensive work-related injury statewide and nationally and internationally, is also resulting in increased costs. And the notion of restriction that was placed on us back in 1989 with Senate Bill 1197 is actually reducing or diminishing proper outcomes for injured workers and increasing costs. This is a study produced by SafeZone Data in 1988 that was repeatedly, consistently mentioned in the lay press via Stanton Long, then president of Safe Corporation, and the notion that was repeated in the news media was that chiropractic, to see a chiropractor is twice as expensive as seen as a medical doctor, and this was the data that Stanton continued, Mr. Long continued to refer to. And if you scrutinized it, the $250 to see a medical doc versus $700 to see a chiropractic physician back in 1988. is a little skewed. The $250 figure on the left that you see is relative to just seeing the primary care physician, the medical doc, the internist or family physician, who by and large, many times do not put their hands on the patient when it comes to a back pain case. They do not, for the great majority of them, provide any hands-on treatment. They do one of two things. They write a prescription for medications, the number one drug class being narcotics, which leads to time loss, and or a prescription for physical therapy, a trial course of physical therapy. Both are direct medical costs. They both require a medical physician's referral. So those are direct medical costs, the direct costs of a medical doctor managing an injured worker case. Well, back in 1988, physical therapy alone averaged $550, pharmacology drugs $200, and radiologists who generally read their films for them was a $200 case average. Without including hospitalizations, spinal surgeries, the case average was right at $1,200 versus the $700 for chiropractic physicians. We are a one-stop shop. We take our own films. We read our own x-rays. We do our own consultation examinations. We specialize in the evaluation of musculoskeletal injuries and complaints, and we do our own physiotherapies. We pride ourselves on not prescribing the medications. Time loss was also shown. Sorry, that runs off the page there. By Dr. Neando back in 1990 to be less during the acute and chronic phase of injured workers being managed by chiropractors. So that is another cost saver. One other thing that's not really spoken of is, and the internists and family physicians I treat will tell you this straight out, they really do not get much training in musculoskeletal medicine, musculoskeletal conditions. Their forte, they're experts in critical care, crisis care, acute care, and internal disorders. But when it comes to musculoskeletal conditions, they really don't receive that much training. In fact, I can tell you a little anecdote of a family physician, young gal that came in to me that had trouble down her arm, tens of needles in her fingertips, couldn't sleep for nearly 7 months. She had been managed. And it was a very simple couple of ribs that were locked up, costal vertebral joints, and she had dealt with it for many months. She had the usual course of medications. She went through 3 courses of physical therapy. She ended up with a cervical MRI, which was read normal. She went to the local medical neurologist that I work with frequently, and he did nerve conduction testing, did his clinical outcomes, clinical exam findings, and said, you have a nerve problem. I don't know what it is, but if anybody can figure it out, this guy can. And he referred her to me, and she had a very simple costovertebral joint fixation and concomitant myofascial trigger point, which was causing the tingling paresthesia down her arm.
Okay, we all clear of that?
Okay, well, so anyway, she had a simple problem. One treatment, she slept the first time.
It's like the ORS is simple English.
And I said to her, I said, so, first of all, I said, well, who, because neurologically she was clear. I said, who ordered the MRI? She said, oh, shut up. She said, I know, I did. And she says, you know, we didn't get this stuff in my medical school and family practice residency. And I said, what do you mean? She says, well, I think, you know, we got about, probably, I think, just about 3 hours of musculoskeletal, and that included foot and ankle to neck. And I said, really, 3 credit hours? She says, no, Doc, you understand, Vern. 3 clock hours is what I'm talking about. And therein lies part of the rub. And so, again, the medical physicians in the workers' comp system, including the occupational medical docs, do not provide any hands-on treatment by and large. They prescribe the meds, they prescribe PT, and we believe that that's a cost driver. There's also, well cited in the medical literature, the inappropriate and consistent ordering of MRI. And there is an element of competition among hospitals and imaging centers. And it's my understanding from my colleagues in the Central Oregon that Bend alone has, I believe, some 11 MRI scanners. I believe there's 7 spine surgeons, 2 orthopedic surgeons that do spine, and 5 neurosurgeons. And that's a cost driver.
Yeah. If I could, I'd like to go back to that previous slide. MRIs no better than x-rays. I guess that's in certain applications, or do you think that's true in every case? I'm quite intrigued with that.
Well, Chair, can members of the committee, what they're referring to is scanning, basically, for back pain.
Yeah.
And you should only order an MRI when there are neurological signs and symptoms that suggest a pathology that would warrant an MRI of spinal stenosis, radiculopathy, or space-occupying lesion, something ominous. But if, in fact, you don't have those clinical exam findings, you should not be ordering an MRI.
So they're often ordered more out of frustration in response to complaints about pain than specific symptoms.
Yes, Ms. Chair, and we would make the case that they're also ordered because of the lack of training in musculoskeletal conditions and because patients demand it and for defensive medicine. And if your information is limited, you're going to be a little more defensive. And if the patient demands it, you're going to be more apt to order it.
I guess the reason I brought that up is a couple of years ago I had a shoulder injury and the ball was severely injured and multiple x-rays picked up absolutely nothing.
Correct.
And it was misdiagnosed for several painful months, and finally, after considerable complaining and whining, I got an MRI, and immediately my prescription was up to tenfold.
Well, that was, you should have been referred.
Yeah.
These are some statistics to put it in perspective as far as cost drivers and where we are on this. So this information is a little old. These numbers are actually increased. Per quarter in the workers' comp system, we're spending in excess of $2 million a quarter for these MRIs. Spinal surgeries, $2.4 million. That has increased. Independent medical exams alone are $1.8 million. Pharmacology, $3.68 million, with the number one drug class still, narcotics, Oxycontin, Oxycodone. We have a real problem with opioids, and it transcends into the workers' comp system.
What's the time frame again, Vern? Excuse me?
I believe these are 2007 statistics.
For the year.
What's that?
For it, the year.
Well, no, this is a quarter.
Okay, that's a certain. So and one quarter in 2007. So it'd be
correct.
Four
correct.
Times per
correct.
Year.
And I'm sorry, I don't have more recent information.
No, I'm just trying to understand what it is. Okay.
And while at the same time, the one-stop shop docs, chiropractic physicians, represented 1.4 million or 2.4% of the expenditures. Oregon has a drug problem. I've been working with the Oregon Health Services Commission relative to low back pain guidelines. The commission has been wonderful about reviewing the evidence, in fact, putting pharmacology in the back of the bus where it belongs. Between 1997 and 2007, we had increased sales of hydrocodone of 280%, oxycodone. Prescriptions have increased 866%, and methadone 1,293%. We have a real issue here in Oregon. In fact, we are the third in the nation for leading in narcotic prescription abuse. 53% of all drug overdoses in this state are due to opioids, which is a 540% increase in 1999. With a 130% increase in hospitalizations and a 1,500% increase in deaths due to methadone alone.
Yep.
These numbers transcend. Yes.
Just a second.
Thanks, Doctor. We're third, and that's per capita, I'd imagine. And then the overdoses, are those patients that have been prescribed those drugs, or that's dope they bought out on the street, or a combination of both?
These are prescription opioids.
Yeah. So the 53% of the overdoses are patients that have a prescription and they overdose on it.
Well, 53% of all drug overdoses are secondary to prescription opioids.
But clarification, for instance, I could get a prescription and that prescription can get taken by someone else or sold out on the street. So, I mean, again, it's still a very, very high and unacceptable number, but the bottom line is it's not 53% of drug overdoses from the people who are directly prescribed that medication.
That's what I was asking. Thank
Mr.
You.
Chair, Senator Hoyle, no, that is exactly what that
Representative,
is.
Representative, but that's okay.
What did I say?
Senator.
Oh, sorry.
We don't want to degrade you.
No, that is
an announcement.
Mr. Chair, just so I get this clear, Doctor, 53% of the overdoses are due to the result of a patient that has a prescription for that opiate overdosing.
Correct.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get to. Thank you.
And if I could, I want to go back a second. You know,
part of the reason we're having this discussion is my concerns about the reality that we're third in the nation on the prescribing of these kinds of medications. And at least in my limited research, the majority of these medications are actually being used for these kinds of injuries. They're not very effective as treatments, and they're the most addictive form of medication just about that we have. So what we're doing is we're addicting enormous numbers of injured workers, and not doing very much for their treatment, frankly. And I just, you know, as one who voted in 95 for workers' comp reform and saw that there were massive abuses, and chiropractors were among those, I'm sorry, but that was true. But we need to look at, in my view, some balance on some of these topics and at what is good medical practice and best interests of the patients. And I think addicting an enormous number of our workforce to very addictive, dangerous drugs that end up in overdoses and all kinds of other misconduct, because we all have friends and family that we've seen the effects of these kinds of medications on, there surely is a better solution to this. I'm sorry to just go on, but let's first take Representative Esquivel and then Representative Matthews.
Dr. Sable, when you say you have a 1,500% increase in deaths due to methadone, was there just a small amount and a double? I mean, that's a pretty large increase. What were the total?
Well,
number.
Chair Kinnemeyer, Representative Esquivel, members of the committee, this is referring to that 1997 through 2007 period of time. There were 700 deaths. They weren't all due to methadone, but a good percentage of them were. But the 700 deaths were due to opioid use.
Okay.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Sabo. Where are these statistics coming from? I don't want to question your survey or your study. I just want to know where they're coming from.
They're coming from the state of Oregon. State of Oregon researcher. I can get you the very specific citation. I took that off the...
I'm fascinated by the number, and the reason why I'm on the front line out there as a firefighter, we respond to overdoses a lot. I can't even come close to even fathom 53% of them were being with a prescribed narcotic. I just can't even come close to that. And so I know it's a small snapshot. That's one part of the state. It's Gresham. I get it. But we go on a lot of overdoses. We use a drug called Narcan, which you're probably familiar with. Mm-hmm. It can counteract that drug and bring them right back. Most time people wake up and we save them from the throes of death, and they're upset because we ruined their high. It's not because they're on prescribed painkillers. They're taking other things. So I would like to look into that a little further, but I want to put that in context for the committee too, that I'm not seeing 53%, but that doesn't mean it doesn't occur, and I'd just like to look further at it. So thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Matthews, this is coming from the Oregon Health Authority. The Health Services Commission cites the references. It's a Oregon State employee researcher. I can't remember the woman's name, but I can get you the very citations.
That'd be great. I'd like to look into it deeper, because overdoses are a big problem throughout the state, and I won't deny that there's a problem with prescribed medications in some cases. I mean, it's like anything, use it responsibly, but we have a big overdose problem when it comes to the illegal narcotics.
Absolutely.
Representative Conger, please.
You've opened the floodgates of questions now, but
I think this is a good point. Thank you.
Yeah. Going back just a couple of slides, this would be your eighth slide. I wanted to thank you, by the way, for giving us copies of your slides so that we can flip back and forth through them. So these are the numbers, the quarterly cost for workers' comp for treating injured workers. And I just wanted to clarify, because I don't think I understood the percentage. So you attached that 2.4% is of workers' comp expense, I take it, is going to chiropractic doctors.
Correct.
So what percentage of injuries, I guess, are of the sort
that would be properly handled by a chiropractic doctor, would you say?
Chair Kimmer, Representative Conger, I would say when it comes to low back injuries, which are the most common frequent, I would say the majority.
Well, but, I mean, that doesn't really address the question. What I'm trying to understand is, I think by this slide what you're suggesting is that, I know what you're suggesting, is that chiropractors are underutilized in the workers' comp system. But what I can't understand from these numbers is 2.4% of all injuries is irrelevant because not all injuries are appropriately treated by chiropractors. So it would be helpful to know how that relates to the scope or the scale of injuries that are appropriately treated by chiropractors, in your opinion.
Correct. Representative Conger, this is relative to payments, total costs, and not frequency of specific types of injuries or by diagnoses. But just by the world's literature and our own literature here, the most common work-related injury are low back injuries, followed by carpal tunnel, and both of which we are well skilled in treating and would work up and treat appropriately with very good results. In fact, the highest number of high-level clinical trials supports the efficacy of spinal manipulation over anything else, and we're having that discussion right now in the Health Services Commission, which has placed that as the number one non-pharmaceutical treatment. I don't know if that answers your question anymore.
Not exactly. It did about halfway, but I guess what would be helpful, and maybe you don't have this information off the top of your head, which is okay. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. You and I have talked before. I think I'm keenly interested. I think we're all, I imagine we're probably all keenly interested in reducing healthcare costs, and obviously in the workers' comp system, the state has an interest in doing that, a direct interest in doing that. But the question would be, out of the amount that is spent, or out of I think it should be the amount that is spent that would be the most relevant to this slide. How much of that would be appropriate to have been referred initially to a chiropractic doctor? So when you say carpal tunnel and you say lower back injury, is that 30% of workers' comp claims between the two of them? Is it 25? Is it 10? Is it 75? I just don't have any frame of reference. So.
Chair Kittimer, Representative Conger, I can get those figures for you. I'm almost certain from the workers' comp division and the gentleman sitting behind me, John Schultz.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions while we're interrupted?
Okay.
Dr. Sabo, please continue.
Well, back in 2005, we proposed a study to look at these very issues and a randomized prospective cost comparison study comparing the cost of chiropractic managed cases versus usual medical management. Oregon Health Science University's Center for Health and Disability Policy was going to perform the study. And during that conversation, Mr. Chris Davies from SAFE and John Schultz, director of the Workers' Comp Division, made a very good point. We're not just simply concerned about cost when it comes to treatment workers, but we should be concerned about the quality of care and outcomes. To that end, these are some statistics relative to lumbar fusion surgeries, and Oregon leads the nation in spinal surgery. In fact, Bend, Oregon is the spinal surgical capital of the United States. More spinal surgeries occur per capita in Bend than any other known city in the United States. This is a Dartmouth Atlas study. And this study is something that indicates excessive costs and procedures that, in our opinion, can be avoided. The cost in both financial and human terms is significant. This is a study by Providence MCO, Managed Care Organization, between 1997 and 2000. These spinal surgeries continue. We actually have gone into artificial discs. Some have failed and have been taken off. Moratoriums have been placed on them, but the surgeries in this nation continue to escalate. In their study, and this is a microcosm of what we see nationally, of 75 fusion cases between 1997 and 2000, 61% had not returned to any occupation 1 year after surgery. 56% continued to need narcotics for pain control. 56 indicated their pain was the same or worse following their spinal surgery fusion. 64% could do fewer activities than they could prior to the surgery. 63% were highly disappointed or not pleased with their surgery. 47%, if allowed to go back in time, would never have had their spinal surgery in the first place. And 25% had additional surgeries since their original fusion.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, there was a comment.
Excuse me, Doctor.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Shaw.
You know, there's a million questions to be asked here, and we're running out of time. But, you know, I would like to see somebody go out and randomly take 100 injuries here and 100 here, the same back injury. And this 100 went and got a fusion operation, and this went to a chiropractor. And then compare those results. I don't know if anybody's doing anything. And one more thing. Today, we're just hearing from the chiropractors. We're not going to hear from MLAC. We're not going to hear from employers, insurers, the Oregon Medical Association. But, Vern, I would like to see that kind of, if there's anything like that out there.
There is. Because,
and one more thing, Mr. Chair, and then I'll shut up. But we're third in the nation for dope and way up here for back surgeries. I'd like to see the numbers of other states and what they're doing and how their results. If you have that, I'd be interested in seeing that too.
Representative Schaffler might be more than willing to give you those studies. I just sent them to the Health Services Commission, who's reviewing the surgical algorithm and the low back pain guidelines.
Thank you.
There was an interesting quote by Mr. Schultz, Director of the Workers' Comp Division, during all of this. And the estimated cost of one unsuccessful back operation resulting in permanent total disability is $1.2 million. Evidence has shown that aggressive rehabilitative exercises and specifically chiropractic flexion distraction treatment is as effective as spinal fusion. And this is being discussed right now with the Oregon Health Services Commission on their low back pain guidelines. We believe that chiropractic physicians, and I would also lump naturopathic physicians into this, could be part of the solution. Our training is comprehensive. We can act as primary care providers for those who wish to practice to the height of their licensure. We're well-versed in differential diagnosis, lab diagnosis, clinical pathology, and the like. We have the capacity not only to work up low back cases, but to recognize the red flags that can be harbingers to frank pathology masquerading as simple low back pain. And we know very specifically what further lab testing, what further imaging to refer for, or what specific medical colleague to send that patient to. To the end, there's a couple studies I'll show you. There's many others, but these are two very pertinent cost studies. This is a 2004 study, four-year prospective study, wherein the policyholders could select a chiropractic physician as their primary care physician or a medical physician, osteopathic physician as their primary care physician. They followed them forward in time 3 years. In the chiropractic managed group, and we think that at least some of these savings, not a lot of these savings, would also be realized in the workers' comp arena. In the chiropractic managed group, there was a 43% reduction in hospital admissions, a 58.4% decrease in hospital days, a 43.2% decrease in outpatient surgeries and procedures such as MRIs, and a 51.8% reduction in drug costs. They followed these folks for 3 more years, 70,274 member months over a 7-year period. Now the savings were 85% reduction in drug costs, 62% reduction in MRIs and surgeries, 60.2% reduction in hospital admissions, and a 59% reduction in hospital days. Those are real savings. And we believe the outcomes would also be superior. Yes?
Representative Conger, please.
Just a quick clarification. Osteopaths, where do they fit into this?
Well, the medical physician, osteopathic physician, and this study were intermixed. osteopathic physicians practicing primary care.
Okay.
To get another view of the cost expenditures in Oregon's workers' comp system and where we've gone as far as cost shifting, this is 10 years after the reforms. You can see on the right in blue, medical physician, this is for entire year, $73 million. Hospital outpatient, $54 million. Hospital inpatient, $24 million. Physical therapist, $17 million. Pharmacy, $10 million. Radiologist, $8 million. And my entire profession, $6 million. And again, we're a one-stop shop. We do our own physiotherapies. We take our own films. We read our own films. We do not prescribe the medications. And we save a lot of folks from spinal surgery. 7 years later, not much has changed other than medicine is now receiving $92 million out, hospital outpatient, $72 million, hospital inpatient, $37 million. The physical therapists are now up to $25 million. Pharmacy is up to $19 million, and radiologists, $9 million, and chiropractors increased $1 million in 7 years. So you can see the cost shifting that's occurring. We believe that at least to consider the probability that returning chiropractic physicians and naturopathic physicians to full attending physician status and at least opening or at least expanding the managed care organization panels would in fact result in better outcomes and reduce costs. I don't think I need to cover that. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be willing to answer any more questions you might have.
Thank you. Committee members, questions, comments? We also have coming up John Schultz with the Workers' Comp Division. So any other questions or comments?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's have John Schultz, Administrator, Workers' Comp Division.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, I'm John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to provide information about injured worker access to care here in Oregon. Worker access to care is one of our top priorities. We know that when workers get access to quality care, frankly, they're going to be a lot better off. It's going to, in the long run, it's going to create less expense for the system. Access to care is a much larger issue than just workers' compensation, as I'm sure you know. And I'll touch on some of those issues as I go along. Oregon is a state where the injured worker is allowed to choose their attending care provider within a few limits. There are many states where actually it's the employer who chooses the workers' care provider. Oregon has opted to allow the injured workers to choose their own attending care provider, and I think that's a very important point in considering some of the things we just heard. The attending physician is a concept in workers' compensation that's important. The attending physician is the provider that acts as the worker's gatekeeper to treatment, as well as making most of the key decisions regarding the worker's resulting disability and benefits that they could be entitled to receive. For example, the attending physician is the only provider that can authorize a worker's time off work or determine a worker's permanent impairment. They're the ones who release the worker to go back to work, for example, as well. There are three types of providers that have unlimited authority to act as attending physicians in Oregon, and we just heard some of that. The three attending providers are medical doctors, osteopathic physicians, and maxillofacial surgeons, and I think I pronounced that correctly. Starting January 1st, podiatric physicians will also become full attending physicians. Other provider types at this time can act as attending physicians, but they're limited under the law for specific periods of times or numbers of visits, and that includes chiropractic physicians, naturopathic physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and so forth. Now, there is an exception, and Dr. Sabo touched on this, and for those of you who've sat through my discussions before, you'll know there's lots of exceptions in workers' compensation. If the worker is enrolled in a managed care organization, or they're known as MCOs, while the worker still has their choice of provider, they have to choose from providers that are listed on the MCO panel. So that's the main exception to a worker's that limits worker choice. We were asked today to highlight some of the changes that have been made in the workers' compensation, going back to the reforms that, Mr. Chair, you mentioned earlier, that relate to worker access issues. I attached a table to my testimony that highlights some of the key legislative actions on the topic over the last 20 years. I've also provided some pages from our biennial report on workers' compensation that highlight some of the most recent information as well as some of the data about care provision and worker benefits in terms of medical care here in Oregon. I provided that for your reference, and I'd be happy to go through that in more detail if you need. Worker access to providers is a growing challenge. Workers' compensation does include more what I call hassles, or others might refer to as administrative duties for providers, than other types of insurance. Only half of the providers today in Oregon are willing to take workers' compensation patients. And there's some reasons for that. We've done a lot of outreach and talked to a lot of providers, and here's some of the reasons that we're hearing about. Too much paperwork. More administrative responsibilities. Injured workers can be challenging sometimes to manage. A lack of electronic billing. Risk of claim denial that could result in no or only partial payment for their services. Less use of pre-authorization procedures than with private health plan insurers, and that makes it more financially risky for the provider to move forward with their treatment. So this is some of the reasons that we're hearing about, some of the barriers. Attending physicians have those broad responsibilities that I talked about earlier. The very nature of our healthcare system is changing because of federal and state reforms, and the kinds of providers that are available to give attending care have changed and will continue to change and evolve over the next few years. And the workers' compensation system is going to need to evolve with that. There are fewer medical doctors choosing to go into general or family practice today. That's just a fact. More are going into the specialties. The kinds of providers that most injured workers have made the choice to treat with are typically the general and family practice physicians. The workers have relied on those types of practitioners to be their attending physicians. They're becoming less accessible. So with all this in mind, the Management Labor Advisory Committee for Workers' Compensation recognized the need for a broader review and a broader discussion of the issues. They've established a subcommittee that is looking at access to all provider types. The subcommittee has met three times since the end of the session. The meetings are scheduled throughout this fall, and I expect they'll continue beyond that. They have been working with us at the department as well as the Oregon Medical Association and other providers to get input about how to quantify and then clarify the problems and the barriers that workers are running into in regard to access for their choice of physician, and they are really trying to drive down into what the root causes are. The aim of this subcommittee will be to address those root causes and to propose solutions that make workers' compensation a line of insurance which providers want to participate in. Last week, the full Medical Advisory Committee for Workers' Compensation met with the Management Labor Advisory Committee in a joint meeting to talk about these access issues. It was a very productive conversation, and there were several things identified that can be done to develop a better understanding of the status quo, what the situation is, as well as looking at some solutions and proposals to get from where we are to where we need to be. Members of both committees identified studies that need to be reviewed in the literature that exists already about administrative processes within workers' compensation and fair compensation for payment. There was a commitment made between my department, DCBS, and the Oregon Medical Association to conduct joint meetings with providers around the state to get more input as well as provide more education to providers. There is the beginning of an in-depth review of options surrounding pre-authorization, which is a particularly challenging area in workers' compensation because of how compensability law works. And then there's a commitment by the two committee chairs made to invite and ensure representatives of each committee attend each other's committee meetings. And that may sound like a small step, but that's actually a big step when you're looking at volunteer committee members, care providers who are taking time out of their day to attend committee meetings on this issue. Just a couple of the other comments I would like to make in regard to some issues that you've heard earlier. The Medical Advisory Committee has been meeting and they are reviewing ways to develop appropriate standards for the use of narcotics in workers' compensation here in Oregon, as well as taking a look at spinal fusions. One of the procedures that we have identified as a high cost, poor outcome procedure. A recommendation to you, and I think this goes to a comment that Chair Schaffler made in regard to getting input and results in other areas, is that you may want to talk to the representative from the Oregon Pain Commission, as well as representatives from some of the other care providers in regard to some of the issues that you heard this morning. And finally, I would mention that the Management Labor Advisory Committee is prioritizing this access issue over all the other issues that have been brought to them on their agenda. There are other technical issues within workers' compensation that bear review that need to be looked at. They have elevated this to their top priority at this time. And with that, I'd be willing to answer any questions that you have.
Chair Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot here. There's a lot going on here. My request of Dr. Sable, I make the same of you and everybody else out there, too. You guys know what's going on. I want to know what other states are doing. In the end, all we care about, all I care about, I can't speak for anybody else. If there's an injured worker, I want that injured worker treated, hopefully repaired and cured and back to work and not getting hooked on dope. I just heard from a constituent who's been on prescription drugs for 10 years, and I could tell by the tone of his voice that he's addicted to dope. Jeez. And they got caught off. I've spoke to you about this case and our good ombudsman back there, but I want to avoid that. But I want to know what they're doing in other states and what we're not doing here. And this is a very closed, invited testimony only. If we have any legislation, everyone will be invited to speak or comment. And do you plan on having AMLAC, the advisory committee, plan on having a specific agenda relating to all this in 2013? And Governor Kulongoski had a policy of never signing a bill unless it was approved by AMLAC. I've had the same policy myself because I don't know enough to override them, overrule them. Does Governor Kitzhaber have the same policy?
Mr. Chair, to your first question in regard to MLAC's work for the 2013 session, they are looking at access issues first, and that cuts across a lot of other issues. We have actually turned to our medical advisory committee first to take a look at some of the issues around narcotics to get their advice. It's a very difficult issue, admittedly, and there's a lot of issues, that there's a lot of things that are going to go into that discussion. I think what I can say today is if the Medical Advisory Committee comes back with a recommendation, typically the Management Labor Advisory Committee takes that very seriously and acts upon it. So I don't want to make a commitment that I really am not in a position to make today, but we are certainly taking a hard look at these issues because I don't think anybody wants to see any workers ending up in that situation. And then to your second question, which is in regard to the governor's position on the Management Labor Advisory Committee, it is my understanding that the governor fully supports the Management Labor Advisory Committee's work. In the past, the governors have adopted policy position, and it's our understanding that this governor shares that commitment.
Representative Matthews, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, so they're getting together, they're working through. Are you pretty confident they're going to get to some conclusion on the access to care beyond 90 days? Nurse practitioners had that point. I mean, there's something that, are we getting progress on that issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, yes, I think so. At this time, they're involved, I think, in the part of the review process where they're gathering information and getting input from as many parties as possible. The idea that non-MD providers will have a larger role in the workers' compensation, I think, is fairly well accepted by most parties. How that's going to work, and then the challenge also of how are we going to ensure that workers go that way, because at this time, workers tend to still pour into MD's offices. So there's some challenges in terms of the legal standards in regard to who has what authority to do what, and then practical issues of how do we get the word out and get people to evolve along with the changes in our healthcare delivery system.
And yes,
I'm also curious, and we can take this offline, because I don't want you to speculate, but I'm wondering, is there further clarification on why, you know, you mentioned one of the barriers is that some of our workers' comp or injured workers can be problematic, or I think the term was challenging. Is there further data on what exactly that means? Is it because our case is challenging, the paperwork is challenging, fraud might exist, tough to diagnose? I mean, is that all part of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, what I have been hearing from care providers, and I think this is more anecdotal than having data on the subject, is yes, there are paperwork, administrative management issues that are much larger in workers' compensation than in other forms of insurance, and that's because the attending physician manages the workers' disabling aspects, return to work aspects, determining permanent impairment. There's a substantially larger set of responsibilities than they typically have. And secondly, we hear from physicians who get frustrated with some workers who are having a hard time returning to work, and that it is a challenging area to practice in. Occupational health specialists have gotten training in that area, tend to be able to manage those issues, I think, a little bit better. But the one point that I would like to make, and this was discussed at our joint meeting of the Management Labor Advisory Committee and the Medical Advisory Committee, is that the incidence of fraud is actually very rare.
Last point.
Yes, Chair, please for continue, Representative Matthews.
I just simply want to say earlier I made a comment during Dr. Sable's testimony about pain narcotic or prescription medications and use responsibly. And I do think there's some overdoses that occur when people are trying to use them responsibly. They either lose track of when they've dosed. Perhaps it's they're taking them with a contraindication of something else. But the bottom line, I guess, is I get where we need to look at this. You know, you have a constituent. We all do. I do think people are using prescription medications responsibly. In a lot of cases, there are some that abuse that, but it's a big problem. So I'll say that. And lastly, Mr. Schultz, thanks for all your work that you've done on behalf of the firefighters. It's been very unfortunate that we've had no less than, I think, a half dozen deaths this year alone with cancer within our firefighters. And it took some time for us to get there. Mr. Chair, it was your leadership, this committee that helped bring that forward, and a host of other people out there that were responsible to help that. But in the end, you're still attending a funeral. But thanks for your efforts, and really appreciate the support you've given. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Schaff?
Oh, excuse me.
It's just my pleasure.
Chair Schaff.
Yeah, real quick. My daughter's world is going to have less of this and more of that. Why don't we have electronic billing in the workers' comp system? What's preventing us from doing that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chairs, that's a very good question. That's being worked at.
I know it's a good question. Yes, Don, why are we doing it?
Well, now, just a minute.
And one of the things that we looked at early on is, okay, is this the government's responsibility? Is this the regulator's responsibility to bring e-billing for the insurers and the medical providers? And frankly, we've decided no, that's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is to promulgate the standards under which that is done and to regulate the system to ensure that it's fairly administered. We are aware that and are participating in e-billing discussions that are occurring here in this state. We do have a role in it. I have been amazed that this is one of the systems where we've seen a very slow movement to that. And I think one of the complicating factors is something that's true in our Oregon system, which is typically the care provider bills are not paid until the clinical notes or the reports come in that they can attach to that bill. So the insurers or the third-party administrators who are actually adjudicating the claims can determine whether or not the services provided relate to the injury. If a worker is seeing their typical family physician, a billing can come in, and it could be for mixed services, some of which is aimed at the industrial injury. Some of the services may be aimed at something else in the workers' health care. So those things get looked at, and so that separation of the billing from the notes is a peculiar problem for the workers' compensation system, but I'm pretty confident we can work that out with such concepts as of data warehousing and things in that direction. We have, just so you're aware, we have moved to e-reporting from insurers some time ago in the medical arena, and it's so much easier and better. I share your goal on that, and we will do what we can to help, but unless you in the legislature disagree and really want us to take the lead in that, we have not taken the lead at this point.
Representative Conger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious how Oregon's healthcare transformation efforts fit in with what you're doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, it's more a question how are we going to fit in with that? We are looking to make our standards congruent with the evolving Oregon Health Authority and the progress that is underway there. If workers' compensation continues to be a different in kind type of system, we're going to continue to have problems with providers wanting to provide treatment to people in this system. We have to be congruent with the systems that are in place for the 97-98% of the rest of the system. We're a very small part of medical care in Oregon. So we are working with the Oregon Health Authority. We are tracking their progress. We are trying to align our systems with how that's going to work. Did that answer your question?
It did. So thank you. I was just going to say some of the problems that you're talking about in terms of providers' willingness to participate in the system or treat injured workers might be resolved, as you said, if you either work through a larger system that they're used to dealing with and that has electronic billing, or you match it up so closely that it's transparent to the provider.
I agree.
Further questions, comments? Thank you. I appreciate you coming. This is a ticklish and difficult subject. You know, it's been interesting to me to go back in memory lane back in the 80s when I was here originally, and we had a lot of these discussions then, and a piece that we didn't discuss today, although we got into the turf wars and all of these, some of these other landmines and closed panels and on it goes, was we used to have statistics too. When salmon fishing and steelheading was at its peak, we seemed to have larger numbers of injured workers on temporary disability, and it was interesting when they might go back to work. So there are lots of confounding and compounding issues here that make this very tricky work, and I appreciate everybody coming and trying to have a discussion about this and to continue to push the envelope to get better care for people that are legitimately injured.
Thank you for the opportunity, yeah. Mr. Chair.
Dr. Sabo, do you have something else you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to make one quick comment. I wish Co-Chair Schauffler was in the room. Relative to the MLAC process, I was a little naive in 2005 when we put forth what was known as House Bill 2588, which is a work comp study bill. Now, I had previously met with Professor Greenlich, now Representative Mitch Greenlich, up at Oregon Health Science University because he's an epidemiologist and research design is his forte. Worked for quite some time. He developed and designed the study. We worked for over a year on that study. We had, I think, 42 sponsors for our work comp study. We were only asking for a study. If full implementation of chiropractic services, in fact, would do what we thought it would do, improve outcomes and save money. When we came in front of MLAC, unbeknownst to me, they had a double majority voting system. I did not know that at the time. Co-Chair Schauffler was one of the co-chief sponsors with then State Representative Jeff Krupp. When we were in front of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, there were four labor members. Brad Witt was missing. There were four management members present. The vote of the day was actually 3-1 on the labor side, 3 in favor, 1 against, and the 1 against is really not was in favor. He just didn't think that a medical institution would do us right. He's a chiropractic patient. His best friend in the world is a fellow surfer down in California. And he just thought if we let a medical institution, Oregon Health Science University, perform the study, that they'll tweak the data and in his words, screw the chiropractors. And I said, they cannot do that. Anyone can get to the raw data. But anyway, he was no, but he's really a yes. Interesting, on the management side, there was four management individuals. They voted 2 yes, 2 no, a tie. That's being known to me at the time. That meant it didn't pass. So the vote was actually 5 yes, 3 against. But since it was not a majority on the on the management side, it was it didn't pass. It was a tie and not a majority. Well, we pushed the legislation, the study, through the House and the Senate because we had such huge bipartisan support. Governor Kutengalski vetoed it because MLAC didn't support it. What that meant to me, and I think this needs to be said, as a voter and taxpayer and small businessman, that meant that two unelected officials were able to trump the will of 90 elected officials representing 3.8 million Oregonians. And I think that needs to be considered. I think that's a problem. They should be advisory to the legislature. They should not be a mini legislature onto themselves. You missed my whole spill.
Mr. Chair, well, Doc, we've been, you know, here's the thing. We go through a lot. We pump a lot of pain in here, and hopefully we get something out of it in the end. And I am just not interested in going through a bunch of painful legislation just to have a governor veto it. It's just not productive. I agree with you. They should not be. We're the legislature. They exist because this body put them in place. but it's just painful. And once again, that being said, we need to get an injured worker treated, hopefully repaired, back to work without being hooked on dope. I'm interested in that. That's a logical approach. That's the whole thing's all about. If you can show us that they're doing what you're doing, what you want to do in this state and other states successfully and effectively, then my question to the advisory committee and those people that go there and lobby them is, why shouldn't we do that? It's pretty simple for this labor to put all that together. But that's where I'm at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffel, members of the committee, well, that was the basis premise behind the study. We were only asking for a study, but thank you.
And I supported the study, Mr. Chair. I am not against the study.
Co-chief sponsor.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you all. Okay. Should we just proceed with the next one rather than taking a break? Let's continue on, and we appreciate everybody's patience and hard work. Another easy, simple topic. At least one laughed. Somebody must have been listening. These are difficult issues, but I think we need to talk about some of these. We want to talk next about family leave. I think part of the context is there's been repeated efforts to modify and change it. And part of that, it seemed, as we were having some discussions with people, is let's talk about where we are and how that stands into relationship to family leave throughout the United States. So let's proceed with that discussion. We have Mr. Wilson here to start us off, I think.
Good morning, co-chairs and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. Appreciate the time to talk about this topic. You're right, Co-Chair Kenmer, there are a number of proposals every session to change family leave. Unfortunately, I'm here testifying in opposition to nearly all of them. The reason being, being someone who works for business in this state, one of the common messages we get is, can we please pump the brakes on the leave provisions in this state? And you often hear that Oregon is very, very problematic in the context of where all our various companies operate in other states or have branches or factories or facilities in other states, that Oregon is consistently a problem. And I'm going to, at the outset, I know we're not going to go backward on any of this stuff or repeal. I know that. But I do want to make the case that it is time to let things rest and let other states catch up to us. Now, I will say that going through a 50-state comparison, there is nothing more mind-numbing than going through statutes of 50 states to ascertain leave laws. We got a lot of help with NCSL, but this is our attempt to do that.
And I want to thank you for that. It was a task I was thinking about for a little while until I realized how daunting it was.
Thank you. NCSL is a good resource, and mm-hmm. There are so many permutations of leave laws. It is almost never an apples to apples comparison, but this is an attempt to make it so.
Okay.
Just so you know where Oregon stands relative to the other states. The Federal Family Medical Leave Act applies to employers of 50 or more employees, grants 12 weeks of family leave or leave for serious medical conditions. A state can opt to basically overlay its own Family Leave Act on top of the federal act, which Oregon has chosen to do. There are 11 other states that have done that. So I think my first point is most states opt to go with the federal law. Oregon is one of 12 states that has, in essence, put on its own overlay on top of the federal law. Okay, most states are not doing this. I will say, in addition to these 12 states, there are a handful, 5 or 6, that have their own niche leave proposals that mostly encompass organ donation, school activity leave, Just some small things where they set aside a few number of hours per year for those types of things. I do not include them in this 12-state number because these are 12 states that have, in essence, adopted their own overlay. One of the features of Oregon's family leave law is that we get ours down to 25 employees. As I mentioned before, the federal standard is 50. So we, in essence, get down into more of the smaller business ranks. There are three other states that do this. Oregon is one of four states that applies to small companies. You have Maine, Vermont, Minnesota, and Oregon. But that doesn't really tell even the whole story because then you have this threshold to entry issue. How long do you have to be working at a company in order to qualify for family medical leave? Oregon, by far and away, has the lowest threshold for entry of any state in the country. In essence, it's 25 hours a week for 180 days. So 6 months of part-time employment qualifies you. Washington is also similar to Oregon in that it's 680 hours in a 12-month period. Hawaii is only a six-month threshold, but Hawaii's Family Leave Act only applies to companies of 100 employees or more. So we're talking a complete different classification of employers. And then most states adopt the 12-month threshold, which is commensurate with the federal threshold of 12 months and 1,250 hours. Now we get down to the level of leave that Oregon offers relative to other states, and I think it's fair to say that Oregon offers the most generous leave of the 50 states. It is not common, in fact it is uncommon, but conceivable that under Oregon's law someone could get 36 weeks of leave per year. And that would essentially be through a pregnancy disability leave, followed by family leave, which is 12 weeks for the birth or adoption of a child, followed by either the serious medical leave or sick child leave. So you can take them consecutively to add up to 36 weeks. Again, I do not want to say that it's common. It is not common. It is available, but it is not common. But we do offer up to 36 weeks. California is the only other state that is somewhat comparable in that it is 12 weeks for family leave, which is for the birth or adoption of a child. They also offer 16 weeks of maternity for a 28-week cap in California. And then you see the other states with their own overlays. Most of them are a combination of, most of them are figured over a two-year period, you'll notice. Wisconsin, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Maine are all between 10 and 16 weeks over 2 years. You have Vermont, which offers 12 weeks for parental and serious health. And then you have all the way down to a state like Massachusetts, and all Massachusetts does on their family leave is offer an additional 24 hours a year in addition to federal family medical leave. So it's in essence 24 hours, is three additional days. Then you get into the definition of family, which this impacts the type of leave for which you, there are serious medical conditions that you can take care of a family member and take that time off. Oregon's definition of family is also the broadest definition in the country. It includes domestic partners, grandparents, grandchildren, parents-in-law. There's been a bill the last couple of sessions to introduce siblings into this mix, and you'll see why we oppose that in light of the fact that only one other state, which is Maine, has put siblings into the mix. But then again, their leave is only 10 weeks over 2 years. We have sick child or family leave, you have potentially 24 weeks a year as opposed to 10 weeks over 2 years. But you'll see how other states, most states comply with the federal, which is yourself, a spouse, a child, or and you'll see here that most other states, to the degree that they expand either to domestic partners, parents-in-law, one other state does grandparents, but Oregon does them all. And so in terms of the family who this applies to, we have the broadest definition. Other unique features to Oregon's law, And this is the, if I could identify a bunch of group for employers, the one thing that probably generates the most complaints is the sick child leave law. And the reason the sick child leave law is different is because it does not need to apply to a serious medical condition. It is for explicitly non-serious medical conditions. And a feature of Oregon's law that is particularly problematic is you can claim up to 3 days with no medical verification. In other words, you can stay home for 3 days and there does not need to be a medical verification from a doctor, and or you can stay home one-day periods over a couple months with no medical verification. And even if you did achieve medical verification, it is very difficult, because how do you get medical verification if you claim your child has a headache? It is a problematic deal for employers as it relates to the sick child leave law. But particularly the 3 days with no medical verification is probably the single biggest complaint that we get from our members. Oregon is only one of a handful of states that does not allow for reinstatement to equivalent positions. Most states have a provision that you can reinstate somebody to their exact job or one that is equivalent in nature in pay and responsibility. Oregon requires does not have the equivalent position. Oregon is one of only a few states that bars employers from counting workers' comp injury time off as OFLA leave. In other words, most states, if you are injured and it's a workers' comp claim, most states count that time off against their state Family Medical Leave Act. Oregon does not. It is completely divorced. You can claim your OFLA leave on top of whatever leave you have as a result of a workers' comp injury. Oregon also has other, and that was enacted in 2007. Oregon also has other family leave provisions that run concurrently with our family leave law, one of which that we expanded this session, and we agreed to it, was we allow for an FMLA-type leave for employees to deal with the results of sexual assault, domestic violence, and we added assault to the mix. But there is a handful of states that do that. Oregon is one of the handful of states. We agreed to that expansion this last session. We also grant an additional 2 weeks of leave for military deployment or for service members returning back from deployment, which is also something AOI agreed to. And we also allow access to accrued paid leave while out on OFLA. In other words, you can take your OFLA leave, and Oregon law allows you to access your employer-provided paid leave while out on that OFLA leave, and that change was also made in 2007. So what I'm trying to do is, in essence, help you to not work in a vacuum as it relates to what other states are doing on their family leave laws. The reality is that Oregon's leave law is, I think, without a doubt, the most generous in the country. Again, I know we're not going backwards on this stuff, but it is sort of my plea to let things lie for a while and let other states catch up to us. And that's where I'll end it.
Chair Schaffler.
Thank you. Thank you, JL. I specifically asked you to do these mind-numbing exercises for us, because there was a lot of nice people that wanted to extend the Family Medical Leave Act to the bereavement of bereavement time for death of a family member. I've never heard a worker come to me and say, I got fired because I took time off to go to a funeral and took some days off because a loved one passed away. I've heard one anecdotal story from a doctor who works at Kaiser Hospital, God bless her. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I can't imagine the work environment where your employer wouldn't allow you to take time off due to a death of a family member. I can't imagine that environment would be a very good place to work. And I know in this day and age you can't just walk off the job site and quit because it's hard to get another one. But I just, for the life of me, I'm struggling with that. I am struggling with that. But I do appreciate what you've done here. I'm confident the good people that support that bill will be back again in 2013, if not in February. But I just want to thank you again for doing all this work. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Sure. Representative Dorn.
Okay. The one statistic that's not on here, and I dealt with employees for 30 years, is how this affects women versus men. And so what is the statistic as to how this affects female employees versus male employees, especially with a sick child? And I assume a lot of this paid is unpaid leave.
Correct.
So, but how does it affect women versus men?
The only thing I can immediately say, Representative Doherty, is obviously women have more access to leave under the state OFLA because you are dealing with pregnancy, disability, parental, and then sick child. So I would say that women probably have greater utilization, obviously, than men under the law. So the impact would be greater.
Are there men that don't stay home with their sick children?
It is not as common.
Okay.
Without a question, it's not as common.
Okay, so
I'm not saying it does happen.
So financially and pressure-wise and work, and I'm going to disagree a bit with Chair Schaffler, is that there is quite a bit of pressure by employers not to stay home with your sick child.
Nope.
And to have the sick... There are people whose children are home alone when they are sick because they can't afford. So I guess what my concern is, and the facts that I would like AOI to bring to us, is really what impact does this have on the female working population in Oregon? I would really like to see that.
Sure. Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Doherty. We can try and drill deeper. I will say the issue with sick child leave is I understand the benefits. And I understand where you're going, but this is also because it requires no medical verification, and you couldn't get verification of a headache anyways. That this is the area that is where the abuse resides, and the gaming resides as it relates to sick child, because you can get up to, it's known in our circles as the 3-day freebie. I mean, there's a name for it within the legal community that defends our employers, because you know you can take 3 days without having to get a doctor's note that says your child is sick. And no other state does this.
Yeah,
and so that is, I understand what you're saying, and I hope you appreciate our view. I wish there was some way to get to
it. Well, I see what it is, and it's also the idea of sick leave, because I read in the paper that the city of Seattle is requiring businesses that have less than 5 employees to grant sick leave. And I can't remember the article whether it was, because, I mean, I remember school teachers could not use sick leave for their child. Public employees, it had to be for the illness of their own. And we had a lot of people that took leave without pay because their kid was throwing up all over the place, and they started throwing up at 5 o'clock in the morning when you're leaving for work. So I didn't know if you were aware that at least the city of Seattle has required that of employers.
Yes, I am. Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Doherty. We're well aware of the sick leave issue, and that does run, that is sort of a satellite issue to this that probably should get folded in.
And I just encourage, because, I mean, when you don't have to worry about a sick child when you're at work, you're not a very good employee when you've got all of these. And so I would just hope that we have that kind of consideration
got
also.
Three of them.
Yeah.
10, 9, and 7.
Yeah.
Worry about it all the time.
Do you have family medical leave?
I don't use it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let me let the chair
just to clarify,
jump in here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I wasn't discussing or referring to, nor did I mention family leave for a sick child, ever. I was speaking specifically about bereavement, the concept of allowing people to have a bereavement time for family leave, which did not pass. That's what I was speaking to. And I'm also a parent of a child, and I've had the opportunity and the resources and been blessed with the ability to stay home with her when she didn't feel well, and I understand the need for that. And I will add one more thing before I shut up. Many of the things that Mr. Wilson's pointed out in here have passed directly through this committee, whether I'm sitting on it as a member or chair, sole chair or co-chair of this committee. So, what he pointed out at the very beginning, we are not going backwards. It's a moot point to discuss the abuse or the need of Family Leave Act related to a sick child. We're not going backwards. It's a done deal. We don't even need to talk about it anymore. It's adding on to what we're talking about here, and that's what brought us here this morning. But I never once spoke to the Family Leave Act and its use or abuse relating to a sick child. I just want to make that, and I support that, by the way, completely. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's go to Representative Conger and then Representative Hoyle, please.
So I have one question and then two comments. The question is with respect to your very last point that you made about Oregon allowing employees to access accrued paid leave while they're utilizing Family Leave Act leave. And maybe I'm misunderstanding the point. Maybe it's just a question of flexibility to take it when they want it. But if the employee has accrued paid leave, doesn't that imply that they can then take that leave as paid leave, and they don't, I don't understand why they would also be taking Family Leave Act leave at the same time?
Well, others may be able to answer that question better. Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Conger. That was a point we made back in 2007, but it was decided, you know, that the advantage of OFLA is you take the leave and you are guaranteed your job back. Anyway, it is a legal requirement. And so that is probably at heart the issue. But I think what was trying to be achieved in 2007 was give people at least the option to access their OFLA leave and, not skip out on a paycheck for doing that.
I think I know some employment attorneys who would be interested in an employer who grants paid leave but won't let an employee take it without losing their job. Regardless of the Family Leave Act, it's kind of a breach of contract issue, I think. But so I'll move on from that quickly.
Those darn lawyers, what do you do?
I know they're everywhere, and they're too much involved in the drafting of these statutes. Just a comment,
Chair. Do you have any comment?
Oh, no, sir. I am always surprised to hear the stories of employers who, regardless of what the law says, wouldn't allow an employee to go home and take care of a sick child or to take time off for bereavement or things like that. It's sort of counterintuitive, and given the importance of employees to the success of most businesses, it seems like those kinds of employers would eventually get weeded out by their own stupidity. But I suppose it is a problem. I suppose that there are anecdotal instances that led to the enactment of these kinds of laws, and as surprising as it is, I understand and accept that. The issue that I just want to bring up is compliance. So I'm a business attorney, and I find the Family Leave Act incredibly complicated, and if I do, then I can imagine how hard it must be for an employee to know what their rights are, let alone actually act on them, or an employer, a small business that has, by the way, many, many, many other regulations from different levels of government, different regulatory bodies to comply with, to understand the Family Medical Leave Act and, that's the federal act, the Oregon Family Leave Act, and comply with it. Oops, they also have to comply with the federal act, so they have to know that too. What I'm suggesting is that by making these things so complicated, what we're doing is we're making them less useful to the people who are trying to help, and we're asking for non-compliance by those we're trying to regulate.
Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Conger. To your first point, it's just like everything else we do in this building. We make laws to bring the 3 to 5% of the bad actors into the fold. I mean, that's what we're in the business of doing. And with regard to your second, I mean, I'll give you an OFLA quirk that sort of illustrates your point. You only get 12 weeks of sick child leave if you take your full 12 weeks of parental leave. Now think about that for a second. In a situation where you have the birth of a child, if you don't take your full 12 weeks of parental leave, you don't get your subsequent 12 weeks of sick leave or serious medical condition leave. In fact, if you cut short your parental leave and say you take 6 weeks, then you only have 6 weeks left of parental or sick child. You have to access the full 12 weeks of parental in order to gain access to the full 12 weeks of sick child leave. It's just a quirky thing. And you're right. It's like, it's mind-numbing.
Yeah,
all
it's
these
not
quirks
quirky,
of the
it's
Family
absurd.
Leave Law now that they just don't make sense anymore. But in terms of employers and employees who know their rights, I will say, I think Bowley's coming behind me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nobody more proficient or better in letting people know, you know, what their rights are or responsibilities under the law. So I don't have a lot of discomfort that people don't have access to that type of information.
Let me get a couple more people, and also we have some other panelists that on the same topic, and I think in some regards it might be better to wait till we have our full panel so we have a fuller discussion. But Representative Hoyle is next, and then Representative Johnson, and then Representative Matthews. So
very quickly, first of all, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming up and talking to us about the perspective of business and having managed people and worked with FMLA. I mean, I understand that it is complicated, but it's important because I've also worked for really good employers, had the good fortune of working for great employers. I've also, in the beginning of my career, worked for some people who are not out of business and really skirted the law quite badly. So I'm glad these things are there. But I know my chair didn't bring this up, but you brought up the three-day leave, and we have, you know, in my county, we have 94% of our businesses are 50 people and under, and almost 22% of the people are uninsured. And I have brought my children to school with other children who have strep throat, who have fevers, who have ear infections, whose parents can't afford to stay home, they're not paid to stay home, and who don't go to the doctor. And at the end of the day, as a mother of two children, because I'm a mother first in anything that I do, the fact of the matter is there are times when you know you can't bring your child to school because they have a fever or they're throwing up. Do I need to bring them to the doctor for that? You know, if my daughter has a migraine, she gets migraines. I know when she has a migraine. No, I cannot send her to school. And should I bring her to the doctor? Probably not. If I'm not insured, I really don't want to bring them to the doctor. If my child needs to go, I should bring them. But at the end of the day, there is a point where you cannot bring your children to school. I mean, we had this with H1N1. I think it might have been the health care committee where we heard this. We had people that weren't staying home, weren't keeping their kids home from school, and it was in this committee. And the fact of the matter is that it put everyone else in danger. So at the end of the day, I understand the frustrations that employers may have, but as a parent and as a manager, I can tell you there's a very real reason why this three-day rule is in existence. And I'm glad to hear you say that we won't be going back because I don't think that that would be healthy. But, again, appreciate the concerns you're bringing forward.
Okay, let's continue on. Although we do need to be brief, we may have a conflict that we didn't realize with the Ways and Means Subcommittee needing our hearing room. So this could get complicated. Please, let's go quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, JL, thanks for this. It's very helpful. And obviously, AOI represents private sector businesses. But I think the other thing to take into account here is the impact, for better or for worse, that OFLA can have on public sector agencies as well. As a school board member, I fully understand the impact on the educational product as well from having to find substitutes to provide for student or employees who are taking advantage of what they can, the law allows them to do, and so forth as well, which can be a really daunting task on occasion, trying to make sure you've got continuity of instruction in the classroom and so forth. You talk about lesson plans and testing and all that kind of stuff that also has to happen in a classroom environment right now. Not to mention county governments, city governments, all that other stuff as well. So, again, not trying to roll back or take anything away, but I do think it's important to keep that out there as well. It's not just the private sector. It is the public sector that is impacted by this as well. And even just from the HR perspective, you know, we have somebody in our district that, the complications of balancing FEMLA versus OFLA and making sure that you get it right, because if you don't, you can have some real difficulties. So it is a time-consuming from the management side also. Certainly it takes a lot of manpower and a lot of efforts to ensure that you're carrying out the laws as they are on the books. So, you know, hopefully those folks that might be tempted to expand even further what we have on the books would take that into account as well, that there already is a significant amount of manpower that's being expended to make sure that we are performing as we need to. So I just would say thanks for bringing this. It's a great, great report.
Okay, thank you. Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, I'll just defer to the agency that's got to testify still.
Perfect.
I think we'll learn a lot from them. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's move on here. Kate Newhall and Jennifer Grimmerson. How are we doing on time? Do we know yet?
We're finding out, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
We're finding out.
we're fine?
We're fine.
Oh, good. Okay. Crisis is now over officially, so.
Someplace
else. What? Yes, they were able to find them another room. So I'm sorry, but we thought things would be a little bit shorter than they have been, but so we're fine on time. Thank you. Please give us your name and let's affiliation. Let's proceed.
All right. Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today with Jennifer Jermanson, who's up at the stand with me. And we also have Amy Clare, who's our civil rights administrator, here in case we've got questions for her. I am going to start, since I do know that even though the room is okay, we're kind of quick on time, and JL went through a lot of the kind of history that I was going to include in my presentation. I will try not to duplicate any of that information.
Beautiful.
But I am just going to give you a quick overview of the Oregon Family Leave Act, and then Jennifer is going to go through kind of a more technical comparison of how OFLA interacts with FEMLA and some of the specifics of the law. And I think you guys can feel free to jump in and ask questions. Jennifer does these presentations for our technical assistance for employers program all the time, and I think is probably very familiar with
questions.
Okay. All right. What kind of slide to know? Oh. And more familiar with PowerPoint. Okay. Fix it for me?
Yeah.
Sorry.
The board should
that was my first session in 87.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I moved here in 88 from Ohio.
Sure. Sounds good.
Oh, okay. It's a meeting where you do have an election.
So as you've just heard, both OFLA and FEMLA provide the protected leave to certain employees for qualifying events. The Oregon Family Leave Act is enforced by the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and FEMLA is enforced by the U.S. Department of Labor. So prior to 1988, neither Oregon, and this is actually kind of fortuitous, I noticed walking in the Capitol a display that I've never noticed before, which is Oregon's landmark legislation, and I don't know if that's a new display or if I just didn't notice it during session because I was too tunnel vision. But we've got one out there for the Oregon Family Leave Act, because prior to 1988, neither Oregon nor federal law required employers to give their employees time off for medical leave. In 1987, the Parental Leave Act was enacted, and I think was one of the first in the nations. In 1989, it was amended to add pregnancy disability to provide time off for medically transfers to different positions or time off if it is medically necessary for the pregnancy. In 1991, the legislature enacted the Family Medical Leave Law that also gave workers job-protected leave to care for the health conditions of their family members. Then, along in 1993, comes the federal government adopting the Family and Medical Leave Act. And this new federal law adopted many of the very same components that existed in Oregon's leave laws. In response to that, the Oregon legislature made several statutory changes in 1995 to reduce the administrative burden on those employers that were covered by all of the separate leave laws. So to accomplish this, the parental leave, pregnancy leave, and medical leave were all repealed and replaced with OFLA. In 2007, as JL mentioned, I'm not going to go through these, we had another several changes to Oregon Family Leave Act, including some additions to the definition of family member, who was covered, and the use of paid time taken during family leave. And I think, just because I was actually working in the legislature during that, I think some of the conversations around that were employees wanting to have a choice on whether or not to use their existing accrued paid leave when they took OFLA, and they wanted to have that choice so that they weren't forced to use accrued sick or vacation leave in doing that. JL also mentioned these ones, but these are other leave provisions that we have in Oregon law that are not exactly in OFLA, but do provide protected leave for Oregon employees. So we've got the crime victims leave and the Oregon Oregon Military Family Leave Act. The last piece that I want to cover before I turn it over to Jennifer is just to give you a snapshot of the number of complaints that Bowley sees related to family leave cases. And it has stayed relatively consistent throughout the past couple fiscal years, getting about 250, 260 cases each year filed with the agency. The last chart that I have is just to give you a snapshot of how many employers and employees are covered at each various level of OFLA or FEMLA. I think what was pretty amazing to me was to see that the vast majority of Oregon employers are exempt from both OFLA and FEMLA because they fall below that 25 employee threshold, about 91% of them. Although, we still have the majority of Oregon workers being protected by at least OFLA or FEMLA. About 70% of our workers are protected by one or the other. So I thought that was a pretty interesting statistic. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Jennifer.
Thank you, Kate.
Do you want me to push buttons or do you want to say
your faces? You can push
all
buttons.
All right, there we go.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Jennifer Germanson. I'm the manager of the Technical Assistance for Employers program with the Bureau of Labor and Industry. As Kate mentioned, my unit spends a lot of time conducting training and providing services to Oregon employers about OFLA and FEMLA. And what I thought I would do is just a real brief overview of how OFLA and FEMLA differ, but are still kind of the same. So as mentioned earlier, FMLA covers employers who have 50 or more employees working in the United States. The Oregon Family Leave Act covers those employers who have 25 or more employees working in Oregon. For FMLA, in order for the employee to be covered, they had to have worked for that covered employer for 12 months, not necessarily consecutive months, but during the 12-month period preceding the leave, they needed to have worked at least 1,250 hours. In addition, that employer must have 50 or more employees within 75 miles of the employee's work site. So an example would be U.S. Bank in John Day has well more than 50 employees working in the United States. However, that particular branch in John Day is not going to meet the threshold of FMLA because they don't have 50 or more employees working within 75 miles of John Day, because there's nothing within 75 miles of John Day that would have that many employees. Oregon, on the other hand, the employee to qualify for that must have worked for that covered employer at least 180 calendar days or 6 months. In addition, the employee must have worked an average of 25 hours per week during that 180-day calendar period immediately preceding the need for the leave. For parental leave purposes, they don't need to meet that 25 hours per week requirement. So an example would be an employee who works 15 hours a week but is employed for 180 calendar days is going to be eligible for parental leave, baby bonding for the birth or placement of a child. For the Oregon Military Family Leave Act, however, they don't need to meet that 180-day calendar requirement. Covered family members under FMLA do include the spouse, the child. For FMLA purposes, the child must be under the age of 18 or incapable of self-care due to a mental or physical disability. A parent is covered. And then under FMLA, there's a service member leave. And for that particular leave, which is to care for an injured service member who's been injured in active duty, it could be a next of kin, it could be an aunt, it could be a sister, it could be a grandparent, for example. Oregon does have additional covered family members, obviously a spouse, a same-gender domestic partner. Opposite-gender domestic partners are not covered family members under OFLA. A child is your child no matter how old they are. In loco parentis, which is also covered under FMLA, would be the person who's serving in place of the parent. The parent, the parent-in-law, a grandparent, or a grandchild are also covered under OFLA. We're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just this particular slide just shows what is considered to be a serious health condition under both FMLA and OFLA. They're pretty similar. Actually, FMLA has a couple of other requirements that the Oregon Family Leave does not. For example, this is the one I love. Requires an in-person treatment within 30 days of the first day of incapacity, with the first visit within 7 days of the first day. Oregon does not have such limited qualifications for that. And another slide talking about chronic conditions. And I believe when employers do have issues with employees, it's not just the sick child leave for the non-serious health condition of a child. I believe many employers, at least the employers who talk to technical assistance for employers, do have issues with those employees who have chronic conditions. They're not absent for a full 12-week period or for a month at a time. These are the employees that have a chronic condition that might need to miss a day here, a day there. and sometimes it's hard to schedule that. Under FMLA, it's 12 weeks per leave year. That's the length of leave someone can get. The one exception for that is for the service member caregiver leave, where an employee can get up to 26 weeks in a leave year of leave to care for that injured service member. Oregon also says it's 12 weeks per leave year, and in most cases, that's what an employee is going to be using. There are a couple of exceptions. One would be a pregnant female who has pregnancy-related disability is automatically going to be eligible for 12 more weeks of OFLA leave for any covered purpose. So it could be a continuation of maybe the pregnancy, maybe there are issues. It could be for parental leave. It could also be leave used for another OFLA-covered purpose. For both a male or a female employee who uses a full 12 weeks of parental leave, that's the only reason they're using that leave. They're going to take 3 months off for parental leave. They're automatically eligible for an additional 12 weeks of OFLA sick child leave for the non-serious health condition of a child. I believe the reason for that is someone's going to take 12 weeks for the baby bonding. You come back to work, you've got a child with the croup or an ear infection, you don't have any more time off. This allows that parent that OFLA sick child leave only.
Yes, excuse me for a second.
I saw some heads nodding back there when JL said that you had to go all the way through, you use up all 12 weeks of your parental before you could get all the sick child. It seemed to some there was some dispute back there. Is that accurate, or you want to rebut that?
Okay, thank you for that question, Representative. You can use your OFLA sick child leave anytime during that 12-week period. You've got 12 weeks in your leave year. You can use OFLA sick child leave. You can have time off for your own serious health condition, for any of those other covered leave events. The only time you're going to get the additional 12 weeks of OFLA sick child leave is if you've used the full 12 weeks of parental leave. To put it another way, someone could use 6 weeks of parental leave. They haven't used any other leave. They've got 6 weeks left. They can use that for any other purpose, including sick child leave.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Benefits while on leave. The employee under both OFLA and FMLA may use accrued vacation. For FMLA, the employee may use sick leave only if it's consistent with the employer's policy. OFLA, on the other hand, and as was mentioned earlier, an employee is eligible to use their sick leave. Something that's not on that slide, though, is that the employer has the right to advise an employee in advance. Our policy is that you use all of your leave while you're on accrued, while you're on protected family leave. So, for example, the state of Oregon, the agency I work for, requires employees to use all of their sick leave, then all of their vacation leave, and then any other accrued leave, such as comp time, before they're able to go into a leave without pay status. Employers who have that policy in place can also advise their employees, you need to use all your leave, and you need to use it in this order.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Your last bullet, federal level, says the employer must continue medical insurance while on leave, and the state says they're not required. How can the state override a federal law? How does that work? Okay. Explain those two sentences to me.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair. Under FMLA, the employer must continue medical insurance while the employee is on FMLA leave. Oregon law does not require that an employer continue benefits while someone's on OFLA-only leave. But many of these leave events, if you're a larger employer, you're going to be covered under both FMLA and OFLA. And OFLA regulations require that when there is a difference between OFLA, the federal law, and the state law, you must go with what's most beneficial to the employee. So if the leave is covered under both federal and state law, the employer must continue the medical insurance. But if the leave is covered only under OFLA, for example, the leave is for a same-gender domestic partner, that's not covered under federal law. The employer would then have the right to say, we're not going to continue your medical insurance while you're on this leave. Reinstatement rights. Under FMLA, the employee is entitled to the position held at the time the leave began, or an equivalent suitable position. Under Oregon law, the employee is entitled to reinstatement to the position held at the time the leave began, if it still exists. And then just a little plug for technical assistance for employers. As has been mentioned a couple times, it can be somewhat confusing, especially for those larger employers who have to deal with both federal and state leave laws. Technical assistance for employers provides a number of resources for employers. We have seminars. We do customized on-site training. We have our Family Leave Laws Handbook. We have a Guide to Leave Laws poster, which looks a little daunting when you see the poster, but it covers not only OFLA or FEMLA, but it covers all the other leave laws that an employee may be subject to. For example, injured worker law, leave for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault and stalking, jury duty leave, those types of things. We have our website with a ton of information, and then probably what we're most known for is our employer assistance. We have a phone line and an email service that employers can call us, email us, and say, I have a question about this, and they generally are able to get a response the same day or within 24 hours.
Thank you. Questions? Chair Schaffler.
Thank you. How frequently does BOLI take an employer to task for violating the family leave law or pressuring a worker not to, and maybe Amy wants to come up and answer this question, and then is there any penalty or anything if an employee is found guilty of abusing the family leave law, or does that ever happen? There's two questions there, Amy.
Good morning, co-chairs Kenemer and Schaffler. For the record, my name is Amy Clare. I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division. I believe you asked how often we find violations in the cases that are filed.
Of the employer. And then, has there ever been a case where an employee was found in violation or abusing and proven abusing family leave? And if the employee is found, is there, other than being fired, I suppose, is there anything else that can happen to them?
It's approximately 10% of the cases that are filed where we find a violation of OFLA.
By the employer.
By the employer. So it's actually fairly rare.
Mm-hmm.
So that means the remaining cases are either going to be dismissed for lack of substantial evidence, or they maybe have been withdrawn or settled.
Mm-hmm.
We do see a number of cases where employees may be abusing their leave, mm-hmm. and that's why we don't find in their favor. We don't have sanctions that, as an agency, we can take against the employee, but the employer is certainly, within their right to terminate the employee right. and do what they need.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the testimony. Thanks. You did enlighten some of the issues I wanted to make sure that we all understood, and that was the 30 days notice required to to file for the leave. But also, I mean, it is unpaid leave at this point. And to an employer, and I'm an employer too. My wife and I own and manage a daycare with 21 employees, 86 kids a day. So that can be a nightmare. And although we don't have family medical leave, we do deal with
26, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to expand. We need to get the city of Gresham on board. Working through it. Thank you for bringing that forward. But we do deal with the drama of the day. We've not denied anybody the ability to go to a funeral. We haven't. We've had employees that have had babies, and we encourage them to return back to duty. I mean, it's just, so I mean, I get that end of it, but I also understand too, and I wanted to make sure we knew, when you talk about fraud or the employee, you know, when somebody takes that 12-week, you know, period to take care of their child, whether they're a male or female, and they're going to be home and bond with that child, I know of people that have built their deck and they've extended their homes and they've done those things, and people will say, they shouldn't be on family medical leave. Well, first of all, if it's paid leave, it's because they had the accrued leave already and they earned it. If it's not, it's unpaid leave. And secondly, just because you are taking care of your child doesn't mean you have to have them strapped to a baby born and you're not allowed to do anything else. And so, I mean, I appreciate the job you're doing. I appreciate JR's opinions here on not rolling back, but making sure that we be very cautious about anything further, because I think it's needed and there's a balance. But it is about 30 days notice. It is about communication with the employer of your intent. I walk through this with firefighters. Our schedule is very difficult, 24 and 48 off. Firefighters don't generally want to take 24 hours of leave of absence. They want to take the time that their wife has returned to work. The city of Gresham has always been very willing to work with them so they can communicate their plan. What they don't want is somebody taking 3 weeks now and then 9 months later saying, oh, it's Christmas time, we have minimum staffing, I can't get vacation, so I'm taking family medical leave. And that had happened prior and doesn't happen now. So a lot of this is on the responsibility of communication. And again, I appreciate your testimony, Dan. Thanks for your work.
Okay. Any further questions, comments? Thank you very much. I think with this, we have concluded our hearing for today. And we thank everybody. Interesting topics. And is there any further business before we adjourn? I would point out our next interim committee meeting is going to be November 17th. And if you have topics or issues that you wish for us to consider, please be in touch with the chairs. That's most helpful. Any further business to come before us? Seeing none, with that, we are adjourned.
Flip-flop. Teresa, you need to